I've got to figure out how to get across. What do you mean I can't? Impossible? Give me a lever long enough and a place to stand, and I will move the world. Archimedes said that, and he was killed by a soldier while he was working on a geometry problem, but that's neither here nor there. It's none of your business. That's the trouble with you always sticking your nose in. You'd think that a woman living alone on an island would have some privacy, some time for solid rumination, some room to breathe, a room of one's own. Well, I'd settle for a room, period. Something with a roof, four walls, completely sand-free. You wouldn't understand.
The name of the play, Across the Distance, refers to all kinds of separation, one of the biggest being the communication gap between the hearing and the deaf. And once you get past that novelty, how does the play or multimedia presentation or musical production work for an audience of the hearing and the deaf? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
In its distinctive way, Across a Distance asks several questions. What happens when the magical first blush of love gives way to the challenges of uniting two disparate lives and realities? What are the possibilities and limitations of attraction? And what's the relationship between knowledge and intuition? Providing some, if not all, of the answers to our questions for us are Kelly Bremner, the director of the University Theater production, which runs through September 25th in the UW's Mitchell Theater, Scott Gendel, the composer and music director, Julia Faulkner, soprano, whose voice we heard at the beginning there, Robert Schleifer, an actor who happens to be deaf, Kristen Hunt, the dramaturg and scenic designer, Amy Free, the interpreter for the production, plus Steve Smart, who today will be voicing and serving as interpreter for Robert Schleifer, the actor.
Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
What an exciting concept, an intriguing concept, to have in a play or in a production a male and female character. The woman can hear, the male character cannot, and to use that as a way of exploring all kinds of problems of communications, all kinds of challenges we face as human beings. Let me start with you, Kelly, as the director. Where did this concept come from?
It came from a dinner date in 2005. Julia and Robert invited Scott and I over just to talk about this intriguing paradox. She, of course, is this fantastic singer, and Robert's an amazing actor, and they had this wonderful friendship going, and it was just a delicious idea to explore what we could do artistically with that seeming impasse. So over dinner, we talked about just getting together and trying to make a piece of theater out of it. And then over the next couple of summers, we worked in a devised theater fashion. We did a lot of improvisation about our personal stories, how we got to this moment in our lives. And we started to center in on this idea of the archetype of the improbable romance, Beauty and the Beast, The Little Mermaid, Psyche and Cupid. And that's where we started after a couple of summers. And then we handed that archetypal story over to playwright Nick Lance, who then took off and made it into the play that it is now. It's no longer a piece of devised theater. It's not their personal stories anymore. It's a regular play, if you can call it that. But it still has that sense of allegory, this mm-hmm. improbable romance allegory running underneath the whole script. And that's what we're working with.
Is it a play with songs? Is it a music all the way through? We don't have to put a genre on it, but give us some idea of what to expect if we show up.
Sure. We feel uncomfortable calling it a musical full-blown because it's a two-person play and only one of the people involved is involved with the music. So it doesn't quite feel like a musical. And frankly, the music is more challenging than you would normally hear out of a musical. So it starts to brush up against the world of opera. Obviously, Julia's an opera singer, so it sounds more like opera than musical theater, too. So this has been one of many challenges working on this production is to simply figure out what we call it. What is it? So we've settled on a multimedia bilingual performance piece, which sounds incredibly intimidating.
The two languages not being what we would ordinarily expect from a bilingual theater piece.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And obviously with radio, we're limited because we can't show the audience right now that here in the studio we have someone signing. And I think for anyone who goes to see your production, they will see visually the signing of a language as well as being able to hear the singing and talking. And that's a particularly striking aspect. Scott, as the composer and music director of this multimedia, whatever it is, when you saw the script then that was put together that has this man and a woman, one that can sing, one that cannot hear, how did you go about creating music for it?
There are 8 songs in the show, and 6 of them happen by the woman alone on her island where the man is not involved at all. And so those really were just sort of how you might normally approach a song like that, where you have a text and you're looking for ways to illuminate the text. And also I've worked with Julia a few times before and love working with Julia, so I was just excited to write these things for her voice, which is where sort of the style of it in a way came from. It's just knowing what I know of how Julia is as a performer and getting to play to those strengths. The really challenging part actually came, there are 2 duets between the 2 of them, and we were very careful to really come up with ways to make them true duets, in the sense that, you know, so often in musical theater or opera you have a duet between 2 people and you want them to take the stage equally and pass things back and forth and have a dialogue going back and forth. And we really wanted to make the music have that kind of dialogue, even though the music obviously can't really involve the man. But there are places where the music sort of fades out and throws attention over to him, or places where in the midst of her songs there are sort of these silences where the man takes over the stage, and sort of ways of making it a true duet in that musical theater sense, even though one of the people isn't singing.
We've got a 2-person show here, man and a woman. I'm wondering if I could ask each of you playing one of those 2 roles to talk about your sense of the character, starting with you, Robert. Can you tell us how you see the man in this play?
Well, I see the man. He kind of is in his own world. It's a silent world. So there's no voice, there's no music involved. So it's a very visual world. And part of the man's world, he does not depend on anything auditorily. Everything is visual. So it's a visually centered world.
And does he have unique qualities? In other words, other than his deafness, is his character in this play portrayed as a separate and very individualized man?
Well, he's a very intuitive being. And he's very sensitive of things around him. And I would say that was probably a unique element to this character. He's very self-involved in a good way, very introspective.
Let me ask a kind of a technical question related to that. And again, when we're in the theater watching this play, we're going to see someone signing for you, Robert, in the context of the play, or just signing for the audience, assuming that there will be non-hearing people in the audience. So what kind of signing do we have in this play?
The play is a bilingual performance piece, which is in the tradition of theater that is actually done in 2 languages on the stage. So we are interpreting some of the play into what we are calling an equal playing ground. So some of it is got super titles, kind of like an opera. Robert is signing, Julia is singing or speaking, and all of it's going on to super title screens. At one point in the story, The way the plot works, there's a moment where they're able to understand each other perfectly because of a magical element that goes on in the story. And then they mess it up, and the magic goes away.
And
they're not able to understand each other anymore. And in that moment, we pull the PowerPoint slides. We pull the super titles away from the audience, too, putting us all in that same world where if you speak American Sign Language, you can understand Robert's character. If you speak English and can understand the music and the lyrics, you can understand Julia's character. But if you can't speak one of those 2 languages, you're going to be in the same boat that man and woman are in the world of the play. You're going to understand something, because when you watch a signer sign, when you watch a speaker speak, even if you don't know those languages, we argue there's an amazing amount of communication that's still going on between the audience watching those performers. And that's where we think the most interesting kernel of this play is. People who watch our show say that they're glued to these super title screens in the first act. And then when we pull them away, they actually get, they get really mad at me at first for taking them away. But after they're through being mad at me, they realize that they're watching the performers in a way that they weren't when they could read their lines. And they're getting, I'm not egotistic enough to think they're getting more out of the performances, but they're getting something different. It's not understanding and following language on a narrative level, on a word-to-word level, but it's, as the playwright says, it's learning to appreciate the beauty of language without worrying about whether or not you're understanding the meaning of those words.
And this story is about two characters who have somewhat different approaches to the world. I mean, again, deafness and being able to hear notwithstanding. One of them was very analytical. The other was what I would say would be more intuitive. Mm-hmm. And so in their coming together with these super titles, is this a metaphor when we lose the super titles? In other words, it's just like any other couple would have. It's a communication breakdown.
Mm-hmm. And we were arguing that this communication breakdown is in part cultural. Deaf culture is a culture. Hearing culture is a culture. So this play is about the thing that makes it an allegory and not a specific story is it's what happens when two cultures that are profoundly different come into conflict with each other.
Any two cultures.
And Julia, how do you see the woman's character in this production?
Well, she's a scientist, and her island is a bit messy. There's a lot of stuff, very interesting stuff, and I keep finding new stuff every day. We keep adding things. Drawers overflowing and a brain kind of overflowing, too, which is, frankly, not very much like me at all. I would consider myself more of the artiste type. But
it's called
acting. Another important aspect of each of our islands is that we have beings that we communicate with. In my case, I have trees that can move using their branches quasi as hands or arms, although they're not articulated as hands are. So for instance, the monologue that I spoke at the beginning is actually a dialogue with those trees moving. So I'm talking to a piece of wood, which I have been joking, saying that I've done it before, I can do it again. But it's a little bit, no, it's more than a little bit daunting. First of all, singing a duet with a deaf man, there are special abilities you have to develop, and also with a inanimate object or barely animate. But she is very left brain and very analytical, and he pulls out of her this other side, well, interesting you use the word metaphor, because that figures prominently in the play itself.
You mentioned that there are trees on stage. I know there's also reference, when I've read the script anyway, I've seen there's reference to birds as part of the other island, which brings up the question of stage design setting. For you, Kristen, as the scenic designer, tell us how you take this play across a distance and visually give us something that we'll see when we walk into the theater.
Well, there are a few challenges to designing this show, I think. One of them is that the distance itself. Obviously, we're simulating that distance in the theater, but to create a feeling of sort of physical and metaphorical distance while still having a unified setting is interesting. So we thought a lot about making these small islands emblematic of the characters. And so Man's Island is a sort of meditative space, and we ultimately sort of went with the idea of a Zen rock garden as his area. So it's very spare, it's very colorful, and he has, which the actor is still probably cursing me a little bit, but he has actual gravel sand that he rakes and moves around and sinks down into as he steps onto and off of his island to work with. But it's very simple, and yet it's constantly changing. And so thinking about him as someone who's in tune with his environment, this is the kind of environment that requires his attention all the time. And then Woman has, as she mentioned, a very cluttered sort of space, or a full space might be a better thing to say. And what it's based on is the Renaissance practice that continued well, pretty much till this day, of creating what are called Wunderkammer, or rooms of curiosities, cabinets of curiosities. Mm-hmm. And so we've kind of gone with the conceit that these little curiosities might have floated by her island, washed up, things like that. And so she's got scientific objects, she's got objects from the natural world, she's got tons and tons of books, and we keep adding more and more. And her island itself is actually built out of books. Kelly actually had some books go bad in storage that we used because nobody in academia wants to tear up a bunch of books, right? So we've got some sort of moldy text about Wagner, mostly. And Shakespeare, yes, that we've actually built her space out of. And so one island is colorful and one island is kind of black and white with little pops of color from all of those items in the Wonder Cabinet. And so they're emblematic of their personalities. And then they have these puppets.
Right, and the birds and trees, they're how do you show
that's right.
Moving trees?
Yeah, the trees work... Gosh, what would be a way to describe it
without?
I usually use my arms.
Mm-hmm.
The trees are articulated like elbows. So at the kind of natural curve in the limb, we've got a joint. And so each tree, there are two, has four articulating limbs, and they can swing back and forth to communicate. And of course, the conceit of the play is that woman does not understand sign language, but she communicates with beings who basically use a very, very simple kind of sign in order to communicate with her. And man, of course, doesn't hear woman sing, but his main relationship is with these birds who do make noise to communicate with him. And so we've got these bright, colorful trees and birds in the space that were really interesting for me to design because they required so much thinking about how ASL works. Actually, both of them did. Even though the birds communicate through noise and movement, we had to think a lot about the dynamics between a speaker, between a signer and his audience, in order to figure out where the birds can live, how high up in the air they can be. There's all kinds of interesting dynamics, power dynamics, about the line of sight,
sure,
for instance, that we had to think about. And Amy, as the production interpreter, was an incredible resource for thinking about how to make both the birds and the trees function sort of sensibly in the world of ASL.
More about the birds. Are the birds actors? Or what are the
birds? I call them actors. I call this show, when I talk about it, a four-character play that two characters are human. the birds, we have a flock of a dozen birds that are kind of mobile, that's inspired by the work of Alexander Calder. And then we have these two trees, and those are being operated by a total of three puppeteers.
Puppeteers.
Yeah. So
wow.
It's both simple and complex in terms of the technology of the show. You know?
And then I should also add in the birds are then, whenever they speak, Elizabeth Marshall, who's the flute player for Madison Symphony and teaches around town, pre-recorded a lot of piccolo and flute sounds that were then recorded and play along with the birds as they move.
Big standby in classical music, yes.
Right.
You know, from Peter and the Wolf all the way back to Vivaldi.
Exactly.
Kristen, you mentioned that Amy played a role as the interpreter for the production. Amy, I haven't really heard of that role, interpreter for the production, but obviously this is a unique production. What is your role?
My role has been unique, and so many people have asked me if I'm interpreting the show itself, which I'm not. Typically in old school formats of accessible interpreted performance, you have one show during the run that puts an interpreter or two wearing all black at the corner of the stage, resulting in this ping pong effect for the deaf audience to have a kind of quasi access. And one thing about this show that thrills me is that it is so different. It's taking access to this completely modern level. And so my role hasn't been to focus on learning the lines of the show like I might do if I was preparing to interpret for a show itself, but rather I'm at the production rehearsals. I'm working with Robert. I'm interpreting Kelly's direction to him as an actor. Occasionally we run lines together just to get a sense of what they look like visually. And we discuss sometimes how to interpret the lines of the script that are written in English.
A question for Robert, though. A while back we were talking about acting technique and things that Julia had to do in a special way. But as a deaf actor on stage in a role like this, what are your tools? What do you have to work with in terms of expressing emotion? Are we more reliant upon your face, your gestures?
During the performance, I have several stories that I express, and I use my hands, which also requires the use of my face, using various expressions and body language as well. There's a lot of grammar in ASL that takes place on your face with mouth movements, eye movements, and how my body moves and uses the space as well. So it will be what I would call an organic sign system that I would use. That it is the language that I'll be using.
There is, of course, a wonderful tradition of purely visual acting in silent films. I mean, that was a highly developed craft.
Yes. For example, when I'm talking with the birds on my island, and they're able to communicate with me as a deaf man by movement, and that's how we communicate. They're on my island. It's just the two of us, so we're accustomed to each other, and I can communicate with them through movement. And for the audience benefit, I sign bigger. So I use bigger signs, which is very different than having a one-line conversation. So when I'm working or communicating with Julia across the distance at her island, I would use a more normal sign space. But when I'm making sure that I'm interacting with the audience, I move into using a bigger sign space. And Nick wrote a piece of poetry in the script. And so we took that text and tried to make it a live representation of that poetry so it would become 3D. And so it would actually literally pop off the page. And so when you initially look at the poetry, you think, okay, we have the 2D, and now we're trying to transform that into something that's 3D on stage so that it really pops. We try to do that and incorporate that, and that's part of really the universal connection.
And so from this friendship between an opera singer and an actor who happened to be deaf, we have this production, Across a Distance. And we'll look more at the production and hear some of the songs from it when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our several guests today, all involved with the University Theater's production, Across a Distance. And our guests include the director, Kelly Bremner, the composer and music director, Scott Gendel, soprano Julia Faulkner, who plays Woman, and deaf actor Robert Schleifer, who plays Man. Those are the two main characters in this play. We'll also have with us Kristen Hunt, who's the dramaturg and scenic designer, and also Amy Free, who is the interpreter using, you've heard it called ASL, American Sign Language, will be referred to during the balance of the hour some more. The question about repertory for a deaf actor. How many roles are there and what kind?
Well, it's very limited opportunities. There's really not a lot available. However, this performance, this play is very unique, because there's not very many actors involved. So I'm really blessed to have the cast and crew that I have, and really happy to be working with you all. But having access for deaf actors to be in various performances is very limited. I'm not versed really in TV or film. I'm not very familiar with that. I'm aware of course, the famous Marley Matlin, who's very involved, and that's really the only deaf actor that people really are aware of. There's a few small roles out there, but she's really kind of the only one that's really well known.
Had some powerful roles.
Yes, for sure.
And what's important to know about deaf culture besides the signing? My understanding is that there's also a cultural difference, and there's things that those who are deaf are proud of about that culture.
The deaf community has their own culture, their own language. Really very similar in terms of having everything that a hearing culture has. They, however, depend on their ears for hearing things and taking in the world through their ears versus the deaf who live in a visual world. They depend on their eyes. And that's different than a hearing community who, again, relies on what they hear. Deaf culture is very attuned to everything visually, and that's how they really kind of make their way through the world and take things in.
If I may say something too, Robert is the first deaf person that I've really known intimately. And some of the things I noticed right away when we started to communicate was the main thing is that you must always look at each other. It changes communication so entirely for a hearing person. It's quite uncomfortable at times. Yes, he's staring at me right now. Because we say a lot of things to each other that have a side to them. When you speak to someone and look at them, it's a direct, very direct communication, and it's a little disconcerting.
That's interesting.
But I've come to get used to it.
So you can't talk about someone behind their back, really, if you're really...
Well, you dare not with a deaf person, let me tell you. No.
As a dramaturg, Kristen, I assume you are providing program notes that the audience will get, you know, help with when they come into the theater. This must present a special kind of challenge if you're introducing them to these sort of two cultural divides.
Sure. Well, one thing I've tried to be mindful of is that we have multiple kinds of audiences. I mean, we have one audience, obviously, but we have multiple communities in the audience. And so as a hearing person myself, I've had to keep stepping back and not making the horrible mistake of thinking that what I'm doing in my program notes is introducing hearing people to a show with something challenging and unusual in it, right? Because we also have, I think probably, I'm very hopeful we'll have a significant deaf audience mm-hmm. for the piece. So what I took as my approach was talking about the way in which we're mostly, I think, using American Sign Language in performance in this piece, which I think is unusual in the theater. There's, I think ASL is a kind of performative language, perhaps more so than English in a lot of ways. And so there's ASL poetry. There's lots of sort of storytelling and stuff that's out there. But in terms of traditional theater, what most people in North America probably are familiar with is performance like the National Theater of the Deaf and some of the theater companies that have formed since National Theater of the Deaf became popular. And especially National Theater of the Deaf, most of their audience is a hearing audience. Something like more than 90%, I believe, of their audience are hearing. And they kind of pioneered a type of ASL in performance that they call theatrical sign, which is extremely heightened. Sometimes you'll see signs made with multiple bodies making one very large sign. And it's kind of, they call it aesthetic sign. But it's for the benefit mostly of a hearing audience to see sign language used in a very different way than it's used in conversational communication a lot of the time. And in this performance, though, as Robert says, he does sign bigger in some moments, right, to communicate with the audience. We're much more, I think, using the language as a language that is aesthetically pleasing like languages can be, right, in a poetic sense. But it's not simply what showing a hearing audience sign for novelty. It's using two different kinds of communication that are equally strange and equally wonderful, depending on where you're sitting, depending on what you understand. Robert probably has some things to add.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to what Kristen was saying. Typically, theaters are designed, sets, scripts are really designed around a hearing audience. And really, there are special considerations when you want to design a set and a script, too, that would match a deaf audience. And then when you try to look at bringing the two audiences together, there's even different considerations. And that's not something that's really been done in the past. So that is really a unique aspect of what we're putting together here. We have, you know, potentially a performance that would be all deaf actors, all signing, or an all-hearing cast that would be for a hearing audience, but now we're bringing them together. And we want to ensure that both audiences, both cultures, have access to what's being represented.
And I can see that it easily then becomes an allegory for any two cultures, any two languages, any two very different ways of looking at
any
the world.
Any two genders.
Yes. Right. Well, let's get into the music of this production. Scott, I know that you've got songs, but before we hear a song, Kelly, can you as the director just give us enough of the plot leading up to a song so that we understand what we're going to hear?
Sure. Scott was saying at the beginning that we have two kinds of songs in this piece, songs that are solos and songs that are duets. So I think we're going to start with a solo. And this solo comes from the end of Act One. Man and woman have met each other in this magical space where they're able to understand each other perfectly. And when they go back to their home islands, they want to meet each other again. And so they trick the birds in the trees and go off on their own to find the same magical space they met each other before. And where this song takes place, woman has accidentally found herself on man's island, not at all where she meant to be. She's all alone. She's confused. She's lost. And this song expresses that feeling for her.
A traveler can leave her home to walk miles over open country. She can drive for days without a human word. From an airplane she can watch the fields shrink to postage stamps. Every morning she steps out the door, she believes she'll return to find the same foot-worn sill, the same accustomed chair, the same square of light, the window through.
The name of the song, Open Country, receiving applause that you cannot hear from one of our principal actors in the play, Across a Distance. And that actually, the singing came from Julia Faulkner, who is the other principal actor, more applause there, and the pianist and composer and music director for the production, Scott Gendel. Well, the character that you play, Julia, woman, catchy name, has these great songs, but the other character, your counterpart, man, what does he have that would be a counterpart to your ability to sing? How does that balance?
Well, traditionally, I mean, this is not an opera, but it has aspects of opera in it. An aria or a song is generally the plot doesn't necessarily proceed, but it's an emotional outpouring. It's a illumination of the character and their emotional world at that moment. What man has are stories, beautiful, wonderfully, brilliantly written stories. And Robert can probably say more about that.
They're like little fables.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, all the stories are beautiful. It's really hard to pick even one to talk about, but each story has their own intentions behind it. And of course, like already mentioned, it's whatever man is feeling at that time, it's his emotional outlet. And he's sharing stories with the birds on his island and also with woman across the distance on her island as well.
One of the things that I have trouble not feeling as someone who is hearing is a tremendous sense of pain at the idea that such a beautiful song as the one we just heard, The Open Country, could not be heard by man. How do we somehow come to terms with the sense of loss that somebody who is deaf would experience in not hearing such exquisite music?
Well, I think that's a common thing for a hearing person to feel. And I don't think it really even applies. I know that Robert gets something very definite out of my performance. He loves, and we've gone to operatic performances before, they have surtitles. So that's like great theater for the deaf, actually.
And sometimes, too, it's funny hearing people will ask me, "Oh, you can't hear the music. I'm so sorry to hear that," you know, and my face, you know, it's probably revealing of what I'm thinking inside, you know.
Eyes rolling.
Here I go again, asked once again, "You think I'm broken or something is wrong with me?" And I still find something in Julia's performance, her music. I know, of course, I can't hear it, but it's very entrancing. And
it's
the movements.
Sorry, I interrupted you. That's another hearing person thing.
See what happens here? This is the point
time of
the whole performance right here.
Oh, and we have these conversations every day, misunderstandings and having to be very clear. And it's not easy. But I will say that the fascination for me of getting to really know a deaf person, the fact that his world is entirely visual, he doesn't miss a thing. I mean, you can't move, you know, an eyebrow without him knowing what you're thinking, which is very...
That's right.
It's very
daunting.
Daunting, yes.
I should say, Emily, that question you just asked is exactly how we started this entire play.
Right.
I mean, that's how, back when we had dinner, that very question is what we decided to explore. It's an uncomfortable question sometimes. I think it can make people feel awkward, and we decided to dive into that awkwardness and see what we could build out of it. And it's this play that's come out of that question.
Yeah. And we'll have some final thoughts on the production, Across a Distance, that's running at University Theater until September 25th, when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we have with us several people from the University Theater production of Across a Distance, a multimedia performance that bridges the gap between the world of the hearing and the world of the deaf, and it's a Madison premiere. It's a world premiere of this production. I'm going to ask each of you to tell us who you are, what your role is in this production, and what you most hope that the audience will go away getting out of the production. Maybe starting with you, Kelly.
Sure. I'm Kelly Bremner. I'm the director of the piece. I think the thing I hope audiences will get most out of it is I hope that they will join us in our trip down the rabbit hole, so to speak, to think about these places that we often feel uncomfortable about as a culture, talking about moments where communication has these seeming impasses, where cultures collide. And I hope, though the piece of theater is difficult at times, I hope they find a particular kind of deliciousness in that difficulty and can see the play the way I do, which is that even though it is a difficult theater piece at times, it's essentially a romantic comedy. And it's a romantic comedy that works in a very realistic way about the ways we really do interact with other cultures and other people.
How about we go to Julia next, Julia Faulkner?
Yes, this is Julia Faulkner. I play the role of woman in the piece. And I should also point out I am employed by UW as a voice teacher on the music faculty. I really hope that the audience can sense the joy that is at the heart of this piece. I have never done anything that is as much fun as this. As a performer, you're always performing someone else's work, and usually it's, in the case of an opera singer, it's a dusty old thing. This is something that we did, all of us, from the beginning, and the process has been so magnificent. It's been one of the greatest experiences of my life, and I hope that that sense of joy comes through.
And what about you, Robert?
Yes. And again, my name is Robert Schleifer from Chicago, and I play a role of man. And I'm really hoping that this performance gives a message to the audience, something that they take away that inspires them to continue the discussion. I don't want them to leave and think that it's just a performance and it's done. I want this to be something that opens a discussion that continues on, and something they can maybe figure out how it relates to communication in their own relationships and their own lives. And as Julia said, this is a very unique production. A lot of plays tend to take from something that's already been written, other people, other work, and it all comes together from what people, other people have already put together. But this work is very valuable, and it's original because it really is about relationships, and it looks at relationships in a way that we haven't looked at before. And I really want people to enjoy this play. I really hope they really enjoy it.
What about you, Kristen, as the dramaturg and scenic designer?
Yes, I'm Kristen Hunt, and I also teach at the UW in the theater department. As a designer, and sort of speaking for the whole team of designers, I guess, I'd say we've tried to focus on creating a magical world, but also simply providing a platform for these two virtuosic performers to do their work. And so it's a fine line, of course, between creating a beautiful space, creating beautiful costumes, beautiful light, but also holding back and letting them be the stars of the show. And I hope that that's really happened. And then as a dramaturg, I would echo what Robert says. I really hope that people will leave the theater with questions, with things to work out, and perhaps even with, I don't know, arguments to have with one another about their interpretations of the show, about their ideas about communication. I hope that, if not going so far as to change people's minds, I hope that this show leads people to different directions of thought than they might have come to otherwise.
And you, Amy, as the interpreter for the production.
What I most want people to see is that bridge that happens between the deaf world and the hearing world, because as an interpreter, I often see the misconceptions and stereotypes that people assume about one culture or another. And so I believe that the audience leaving this piece will shatter some of those misconceptions. They'll see that deaf culture has unique features. They will see that deaf people have a way of appreciating music and artistry. They'll see that sign language doesn't mean you can fingerspell your name, that it's something so much more rich and deep and meaningful. So I would love for people to come away and just have a new perception of what is theater for the deaf, what does it mean to combine these performance venues together, and just to have that new realization that this is a new way to provide accessible theater. It doesn't have to be something that is just an interpreter on the side of the stage, but it can be all-encompassing.
Scott Gendel, the music director and composer for this work, we have one more song. And what can you tell us about it and what you hope to accomplish with this production?
Well, I think as a composer, it was in a way a particular challenge because, you know, what I'm writing as music is only for half of the audience in some ways. And so what I'm really hoping people get out of it is, you know, being able to see the parallels between what the music is doing and how also what Robert's storytelling is doing is a parallel to that, and how his performance and her performance both have those same dynamic qualities that the music has. The music will be performed in the pit. We've got the Sole Nero duo, which is Jessica Johnson on the piano and Tony DeSanza on percussion from the university, and they're really amazing. And the sort of all the colors that come out of the percussion and the piano, and all the colors that come out really in the way Robert performs, you know, sort of having people really see those parallels and not feel like there's something missing from one half, but really get that sense of, you know, how much richness of performance can come out of music, and also how much richness of performance can come out of just the whole show.
And the name of the song is?
The name of the song is Your Hands. And it comes from a moment in Act One when everybody is, when they're on their magical islands and everything is perfect. And they have this duet. This is one of the duet songs we were talking about earlier. And they have this beautiful duet between man and woman where she describes his hands and he describes her voice.
And we won't be able to see the sign language that an audience would see going on as part of this duet, but we'll have to, for a radio audience, have to imagine that.
Yes, and you may notice a few occasional pauses that you might not expect and things like that, which are places where his description of her voice sort of take over the texture of the duet.
And I wanted to add something that's really important. Traditionally, for theater access, you have the interpreters, like Amy described, in the corner, and you have the audience that's off to the other side. So again, she described it as the ping pong effect. But there's also something called shadow interpreting. But that too sometimes gets confusing when there's an interpreter following or someone signing behind the hearing actor. And so we discussed various possibilities for how we were going to do this, and we decided that we were going to get rid of all of those traditional means and just have a raw production. And I wanted to mention that because I felt that was an important component to this. And again, it's original. It's a new concept. Deaf audiences are very used to having to look at the corner for the interpreter and then back at the stage and try and get something from the performance. And it was almost like having to spoon feed them the performance. And we've eliminated that barrier so that deaf individuals have access to this fully.
Your hands.
Our hearts, the rain.
The name of the song is Your Hands. It's in the theatrical production Across a Distance by Nick Lance, and the music is by Scott Gendell, who is also the pianist there. The soprano playing woman is Julia Faulkner. Also with us have Ben, the director, Kelly Bremner, and Robert Schleiper, who just happens to be deaf, the other actor who plays man in this play. And we had with us also Kristen Hunt, the dramaturg and scenic designer and interpreter, Amy Free. Thanks one and all for being with us for this conversation and telling us about what promises to be a fascinating production.
And we'll put a link to the University Theater production of Across the Distance, including a brief video clip, on our website at University of the Air on WPR.org.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 as Tino Baglio fills us in about the phenomenon of the foreign film renaissance on American screens. What made it start and what made it end? Join us next week for University of the Air here on Wisconsin Public Radio.